It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Hey guys, man, I'm excited today. It's Monday. I know, it's not really Monday, it's Tuesday. And if you thought it was Monday, guess what? It's Tuesday. The good news is, it's a short week. The bad news is, most of us are a little disoriented because we usually go back to work on Monday. So, again, that's why I'm a big proponent. We should all be pushing, we should all be encouraging our, our work society, if you will, our entrepreneurs, our business owners, to move everything to a four-day work week. So you work Monday through Thursday, and you're off Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Wouldn't that be just a wonderful change? I mean, most of us will just be so rested. I mean, you could take Friday to decompress. Saturday, you do your chores, and you have plenty of energy and time to do your date with your spouse. And then Sunday, you continue to rest and relax. Total recuperation. Hey, speaking of change, my first guest, Dr. Linda McCarthy, back on the show today. I'm excited to talk to her. As you guys know, Dr. Linda is one of our regular contributors, and I'm excited to have her back. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Linda. She has a PhD in metaphysical counseling and is a board-certified life strategies coach with the American Association of Drugless Practitioners. She's a member of the American Holistic Medical Association and co-author of the number one best-selling book, The Wellness Code. Linda is also an inspirational speaker, featured contributor to online magazines, and winner of the Editor's Choice Award for The Wellness Code. As a life makeover expert, her passion is to show clients how their thoughts, feelings, and emotions have a profound effect on their mind, body, and spirit. Linda is located in Scottsdale, Arizona, but offers phone consultations throughout the United States. As always, it's fun and my pleasure to have Linda, Dr. Linda McCarthy, back on the show. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you so much. Happy September. Gosh, can you believe it?
I know.
I was out this weekend and there were holiday decorations for Thanksgiving and Christmas already.
Unbelievable.
Like, slow down. It's still summer, well, I think it's still summer.
It is. I believe that, for most of us, it's still in that summer mindset. Now, I have to tell you, what's even more alarming is we had a planning meeting today about our January show that's going to be focused about goal setting, and that was, you know, I was thinking the same thing. Oh, my gosh, really, we're planning January show already? That is just... That is just too much.
I know. Time truly is flying.
I know. And like I think we discussed this before, hopefully we're all having fun. That's why it's flying by so quick, right?
Exactly. Well, that's my belief, and I'm going to stick with it. So.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of belief, let's talk about this. Because last time you were on the show, we were talking about, you know, our beliefs. We were talking about our perceptions and that you can change your perception when you are ready. You can do it quickly. But these changes affect relationships. Let's talk about this.
Well, you know, when people get excited about making changes, any changes really in their life, they want to go home and share it with their family and friends.
Right.
Now, if you have a strong support system, that's awesome. But most of the time, people don't have that. And the problem with that is that many people don't like change. So when they see somebody that they care about changing, their first line of defense is to just put them down and criticize what they're doing and relate to them some distorted version of their belief of reality of why it's going to fail. And what that does is it causes a person to start second-guessing their decisions to make positive changes in their life. So one of the first things that I do when this happens to a client, I ask them to define what their feelings are, what it means to them, because words have different meanings for different people. So if someone says to me, you know, gosh, I think this might have been a mistake, that could just mean they're throwing in the towel. Or it could just mean that they need more tools to help them stay on task. And most new clients, I call it, you know, they just need emotional CPR to breathe new life and a new sense of self back into them. So for me, it's critically important that I understand the meaning behind their words, because that way we can move forward together and we stay on the same page.
Yes. You know what? And it's funny you should say that, because really we do all have different meanings, even though we assume that all meanings are the same.
Well, we know what assume means, right?
You know, and I chuckle about this because, for you know, it took me, I don't know, this happened to me like 3 or 4 or 5 times in a row. I was a slow learner. But, you know, when I was, younger, I would, you know, go through a drive-thru to grab a burger. And I would say, hey, you know, I want a burger, you know. And typically I'm thinking Wendy's, grab their singles. Well, guess what? Their idea of a burger and my idea of a burger is completely different. They have, you know, different ingredients. And so it took me about the third time or the fourth time before I realized, okay, I want a burger, but I don't want this on it, and I don't want this on it. Would you please add this instead? And after that, I, you know, my meaning was understood. And that's just a simple burger. Could you imagine, you know, us humans, how more complicated we are than just, you know, correcting a burger order?
Exactly. And that's why it is really important to understand the meaning behind somebody's words.
Absolutely. Let me get your opinion on this. Why do you think are the reasons behind our friends and families not wanting to see each person change their life for the better? Walk me through this.
You know, this is so important to understand and even more important to recognize. So as I said before, look, don't be surprised if those closest to you try to sabotage your efforts. Sometimes people unconsciously try to do it just to keep you tied up with your old self, but it's really to protect them from having to change. And years ago, I learned this from Dr. McGraw, and he said, take into consideration what others have to say, but also keep in mind their possible motives. So here are 4 just, they're real basic, typical behaviors that people use to try and stop you, whether they realize it or not. And it's really important to be aware of these patterns so you don't allow this toxicity back into your life. Okay, so the first one's overprotection. The underlying message here is fear. So they'll say, you know, there's no reason for you to change. I don't want you to get hurt again. Okay, it sounds lovely. Sounds lovely. But the pattern's dangerous because it's disguised as love and concern. So again, be conscious of their motives. The second one is power manipulation. And this form of sabotage, people attempt to take away your personal power in order to maintain that old relationship with you. So they'll talk to you almost like a child, hoping you will take their suggestions as such. So someone may say, oh, you know, I get it. You don't have time for me, but now you have time to go to the gym. Or something like, you know, do you know how tough the job market is? You'd be crazy to look for a new job now. This is a power manipulation move. The third one is leveling, and I think most of us have heard of leveling. People who are inadequate will try to level those who have what they want. So your success could pose a threat to them. So it causes them to sabotage you in a way that they can bring you down to their level. So don't get sucked into that drama. Stay away from it. And the last one is safety and status quo. And what that means are people are comfortable with the situation just as it is, even if it's bad. A change for the better is still a change, and it's a threat to what's familiar and the status quo. So don't be surprised if others perceive your desire to change as something that's threatening and they need to destroy it. Again, these behaviors are usually, not always, but usually subconscious, and fear is the driving force behind it. So the good news is once you recognize it, you can adjust accordingly.
Okay, so let me ask you your opinion on this.
Okay.
What do you think about just cutting these people out of your life? I mean, sometimes that's easier said than done. Obviously, if you're married to them and they're being negative Nellies, I think that's going to be tougher to do. But what do you think, you know, what would you offer to your clients, cutting people out or trying to work with them? What's your take?
Well, I have some tips. And first of all, Look, make sure that you're not participating in the sabotage game yourself by saying that, you know, you want something, and then you'll go about doing everything you can to make sure it doesn't happen.
Right.
Self-sabotage, it's a human condition in all of us, and we don't need help from anybody else to do that. So, first of all, negotiate a change in their behavior. It's critically, critically important that you drop the he, she doesn't understand me. That ship has sailed. Let it sink. Let it sink. They don't need to know why you want what you want, but they do need to know how they can support you. So it could seem obvious to you that going to a all-you-can-eat buffet is not a good idea for somebody who's trying to lose weight. So you need to speak up. So figure out how you need to be supported and ask for it. So your mistake may be in assuming that those around you know how to support your efforts, so have the courage to let them know. But if someone close to you is sabotaging your efforts, you owe it to them to offer direction. So think about how you want to be supported, what specific things you need to help you, and be clear and direct in asking for support. Give them a chance. Give them a chance to get on board. The third thing is change yourself.
You know what, and what, I want to say this real quick. What I love about that is, again, that a whole assumptive thing. People really do not know how to support you. You know, people do not elicit love or support the same way that you might. I think it's a great idea to tell your people, listen, I am doing this. I'm going back to the gym, or I'm going to try this diet, or I'm going to, you know, adjust my career, and this is how you can support me. Lay it out for them. Make it stupid simple. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I see so many relationships fail for that exact reason, because your idea of love and my idea of love may be two entirely different things. So you have to let me know what your idea is. How can I support you to make you feel more loved? And I need to do the same to you.
I love it.
So the third thing is change yourself. So if you've stopped smoking, declare it. Say, you know what, I'm a non-smoker, or I choose healthier food options. In psychology, this is referred to as boundary selection. So you purposely decide what you will and will not do, regardless of what anyone else thinks. It's a done deal. But if none of the above work, then the last option is change the situation. So to answer your question, you can either change your goals to appear a little less threatening, or it could be something as drastic as changing your whole tribe. And what I mean by that is just completely surrounding yourself with the only people who support you instead of those who sabotage you. Because it's your life. And the reality is, the only person who has a final say over your thoughts and decisions is you, not anyone else. So don't give them that power.
I love it. Because, you know, again, it's really about us. It's not out there. What did you say in the beginning? I forgot how you phrased it, but you said the ship has sailed, and that's true. You have to realize at this point in your life that it's not out there. It's not them. It's not her.
Somebody.
It's not him. That's right. Don't blame anybody. It's just, you know, take charge of your life. Take charge of how you think, how you're going to feel, and then ultimately what reality you're going to create. Because if you look at the most successful people, whether you like them or not, this is what they do. Whether it's Lady Gaga, which a lot of people are repulsed by her, but guess what? She is an outstanding artist, and she has created her reality. And so whether you dislike her music or not, you got to give her props for controlling how she thinks, putting not listening to the naysayers, and just, you know, hey, this is who I am. This is my brand. Boom.
Right. Well, too many people are willing victims to give over their power. I'll give it over to you, whether it's in religion, in the office, whatever. I will give you my power, and therefore I don't have to take responsibility for any of the circumstances that happened to me.
I love it. Hey, we're out of time, but always good to have you back. And, you know, I'm thinking that I would love to get your input in our January goal setting show as well, because I think it's always important to get somebody with your background as a metaphysician and a board-certified life strategist coach to talk about goals. So we'll have you back for that. Here we are planning January already.
And I'm going to talk to you next week. So
That's right. It's going to be great. All right, so I want to give this out, though, because what you do is so important. So if the people who are listening right now would like to possibly look at changing, maybe heading off in a new direction, check out newdirectioncoaching.com. That's newdirectioncoaching.com, and speak with Dr. Linda McCarthy, and she'll be glad to help you out. Dr. Linda, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thank you. Have a great week, everyone.
All righty. We'll talk to you later. Guys, we're off and running. I just got informed by our station here that we're having a little bit of tech issues. Hopefully it won't affect our show, but they just gave me a preemptive warning there. My next guest, Jeffrey H. Belote, and I hope I got that right, Jeffrey. If not, correct me when I come back. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase Mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, Jeffrey H. Belote, real estate attorney. Jeffrey concentrates on civil litigation matters with an emphasis in real estate. He prosecutes and defends actions in commercial and real estate litigation with an emphasis in the areas of commercial contracts, corporate, limited liability company, and partnership disputes, commercial and mortgage banking, foreclosure, fraud, commercial and residential construction disputes, real estate brokerage disputes, seller and broker misrepresentation, title insurance, escrow, adjoining, landlord and boundary disputes. If it has to do with real estate, Jeffrey Belote handles it. Jeffrey, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so let's talk about this real quick because, you know, here you are, you're an attorney, and by law, you are not allowed to represent me and the opposing party, correct?
That's correct.
But yet, in something as critical as real estate, that is allowed most of the time by these, you know, what do you call it, dual agency brokers, right?
Yes, it is. That's true. There are. That's one of the areas where it's carved out. Real estate brokers are allowed to represent both sides. There are a significant number of disclosures. And might I also add that I'm in California, sitting in my office in San Francisco, California, right now, and I'm talking from a California perspective.
Right.
You're nationwide, so I want to make sure that everybody knows that we're talking. I'm generally talking from a California perspective. Real estate law is state-made law for the most part. There are, of course, federal laws which apply to real estate in certain circumstances, but for the most part, it is generally state-made law. That being said, a lot of the things we can talk about today are areas where everybody across the country should be aware and should be involved with keeping, especially sellers of real property, keeping track of what they're doing and trying to avoid a conflict.
Sure, sure. And just again, I want to emphasize this, that you are, again, in California. If you have questions about anything that Jeffrey says today, by all means, either consult with him directly or talk to your regular attorney regarding anything mentioned here. So don't take it as concrete advice or anything like that. Just want to make that, you know, absolutely clear.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So let's talk about this. All right. Let's talk about the whole, what do you call it, sellers of residential property and what they need to know about disclosures before they sell. Walk me through this because that's what, you know, you mentioned disclosures right in the very beginning of the segment. So walk me through here. What do sellers of residential property really need to know about disclosures before they sell?
Okay, the first thing they need to know is that there is a very strong body of law that has come up through the years, both judicially created law, that is judge-made law or case law, and statutory law. And these laws require sellers to make sure that they are giving an open and complete divestment or disclosure of everything they know about the property that might affect the value or desirability of the property. So anything that they know, of which they're aware, at least in California, this is the law. And generally, I know in a number of other jurisdictions, it also is the law.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. I'm selling my property. I'm selling to you as is. Does that give me any kind of coverage in California?
Boy, that's a great question. You know, as is in a commercial setting where the buyers and seller are on a basically equal intellectual footing, and they have, you know, you generally they'll have attorneys involved. They'll be much more sophisticated. It does carry with it certain protections for the seller. In a residential transaction, 1 to 4 units in California, an as-is provision does not carry anywhere near the provisions that a person, say they were selling a car or something else, would necessarily think they might have. For instance, it does not relieve a seller from telling everything they know about the property. You can't just say, hey, I'm selling this as is, and you know, you go out and investigate whatever you need to investigate, because I don't want to be involved with it anymore, and I'd rather just let you know it's as is and reflect that in the price, not have to even discuss it. That's not the law. The law is the sellers have to disclose, still pursuant to both the statutory scheme and the judicial scheme, anything and everything they know about the property that might affect the value or desirability of the property.
Gotcha. Yeah, you know what, and I like that. I like that because it really puts the the responsibility on the seller. Bottom line is he's selling it as is, but he still has to let you know that the roof is leaking, it hasn't been replaced in 10 years, and it's got this problem and it's got this problem. That way, not only do you know what you're getting into, but you know, you really know what it's going to cost you.
Exactly. And it puts you on notice so you can do further investigation and due diligence during your escrow period to find out if there's anything else out there. I mean, if you hear, you learn from the seller that a window is leaking, well, that means that perhaps there may be dry rot around that window, there may be dry rot within the walls, there may be other problems that are evident, and so it does put a party on notice. And I will tell you that this is one of those areas where, in California, it's somewhat deceptive, in that a seller will get a two-page what's called a transfer disclosure statement. And this is basically a form that follows Civil Code 1102. And it is just a check-the-box kind of thing, looks fairly innocuous, looks easy to fill out. There's a few lines if you have something else to say there. But it is incredibly deceptive in that it really does carry quite a bit of weight if you're inaccurate in that description. And what I always tell sellers is, look, it's always easier to just tell everything about the property. If you have to ask the question, do I need to disclose something? The answer is yes, you should disclose it. That's always the easiest way. And if you have to attach sheets to it, if you had to attach 10 pages to it to talk about every single little crack in the sidewalk or crack in a wall, you should do so. Buyers are incredibly forgiving on the front end and will overlook almost anything when they have that euphoria of the purchase, and they want that property, you know, they want to have it now, and they're willing to overlook and plan to pay for things. Whereas if they learn about it afterwards, it's a whole different story, especially, and I can tell you from my experience in California.
Right, because afterwards you feel like you got ripped off. Whether it's a $10 widget or a $1,000 repair, you feel like, hey, this guy, you know, if he lied about this, if he didn't disclose this, what else is he hiding, right?
Exactly.
Hey, let me get your take. Over the years, how has disclosure law changed? What's your take on this? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse?
It's gotten more technical, and certainly I know that buyers and sellers have gotten more sophisticated. Generally, before the early 80s, it was mainly case law, except for instance, in San Francisco, there was a form that was required. It's called a 3R report here in San Francisco that was a very rudimentary, and it's still required even today, sort of a precursor to the transfer disclosure statement. It was very broad from the case law. You still had a duty to if you knew something about the property, to disclose it. But there were no forms that really put you on notice to say, look, you've got to tell us everything about the property, anything that's material or anything that affects the value or desirability of the property. In the 1980s, some case law came out, especially a case Easton versus Strasburger, and out of that, statutory laws were developed, and now there are burdens and duties both on the brokers as well as on the seller to make certain disclosures. With regard to the brokers, their only duties are, and this is the brokers for either side, whether it's the sellers or the buyers, their only duty is to make a reasonably diligent visual inspection and to note anything in their section of the transfer disclosure statement that comes out of that. They don't have a duty to crawl under the house. They don't have a duty to be to have the qualities of a contractor or an engineer or anything like that. They're just expected to do a reasonably diligent visual inspection. So it's somewhat limited in terms of brokers. Of course, if a broker is put on notice of something that they know about the property that's wrong with the property, they would have a duty to disclose it to the buyers at that point.
Gotcha. Hey, okay, so let me ask you this. I just got this on our Facebook page. So, you know, so is it now better to get an attorney to help you with your real estate transaction instead of a real estate agent, or a real estate agent still good as long as they don't represent both parties? What's your take on this?
That's a great question again. Number one, at least in California, we have very sophisticated real estate agents and brokers here. I'm always of a mind I really don't like a dual agent. I think it's just very difficult to be a dual agent. It does happen, there's nothing illegal about it. Generally, where dual agency works the best, if it works at all, is when you have a brokerage who has perhaps two different agents within that brokerage who are representing respectively the seller and the buyer, and those parties, they can really step back and handle it better. But it is important to hire strong agents and brokers. You know, you can look on the Department of Real Estate website, investigate the broker or agent, find out a little bit about their background, ask friends and neighbors, maybe even go on and see if they've been sued. Look at some of the websites for the Superior Court and find out if they've ever been sued before. These are good things that you can find out about any person that you're dealing with respect to your home, whether it's a contractor or a real estate broker or whatever. But it's good to hire, very important to hire, and I think it's important to hire a broker because they will perform functions that an attorney won't. They're going to give you opinions and concepts and research regarding value, whereas an attorney will be looking at the legal end of it, and somebody like I do get involved. Brokers and agents do refer matters to me where they'll say, hey, we've got these reports. I'm representing a buyer. We have to either waive this contingency on the property inspection, or we need to explain to them why we need something else. And they'll bring these reports in. I will help them. If necessary, we have experts available that can go out and do a subsequent inspection of the property if needed. So those are the kinds of things. It is anytime you have a question about a particular transfer disclosure statement, I mean, it's important to follow up on these. I can't tell you how many I've seen in a file. I've looked at it in a file. There's a box that's checked, but nobody ever followed up. Why did, if the box is checked, for instance, it says that there was unpermitted portions of this property or some of it was built not in compliance with building codes, but the seller didn't explain that. That's a failure on the part of the buyer's agent to catch that and to point it out to the buyer to say, hey, we need to find out what does this mean?
Right. Hey, Jeffrey, we got to go. I'm out of time. I'm getting, looks from my producer. So,
alrighty.
So, but anyway, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. Guys, if you have questions about law, about real estate law, specifically in California, if you just want to get a second opinion, check out Jeffrey Belote at mpplaw.com, mpplaw.com. Jeffrey, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Guys, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to be right back talking with Jennifer Anderhold right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, right, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, Jennifer Anderhold. I accidentally said Anderhold, but anyway, it's Jennifer Anderhold. Jennifer Anderhold is the founder and CEO of BeABestseller.com. BeABestseller.com. I just love simple names that tell you what it is they do. Not only is this great for us as consumers, but it's also, in this case, not a bad for marketing in the sense that it's a keyword phrase. Anyway, got off the subject. Jennifer Anderhold is the founder and CEO of BeABestseller.com, a website and inbox magazine dedicated to evaluating, elevating the voices of entrepreneurial authors around the world. Prior to founding BAB, Jennifer worked in a variety of industries ranging from the Fortune 500 to a small entrepreneurial ventures. Most recently, as a digital marketing consultant, Jennifer created water monitoring training video for C1 agent Storm Water Solutions, whose water monitoring program was utilized during Deep Water Horizon oil spill in the Gulf. The video is currently being utilized for trainings worldwide. Additionally, Jennifer has received several literary recognitions for her writing. Her accomplishments include being the grand prize winner in the 2012 Spectacular competition for screenplay, Oasis for the Soul, a finalist in the People's Pilot Competition for Educational Series Premise, Jeffrey Bean, a finalist in the acclaimed TV Writing Competition for the spec script Popular, Let the Games Begin, and a semi-finalist in the North American Poetry Contest for the poem Soul Camping. Love it, Soul Camping. Jennifer Anderhold, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here today. How are you?
I'm excited to have you. I love your energy. All right, so let's dive into this. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your online publication, BeABestseller.com.
Sure, I'd love to. Well, I think as you saw from my intro, which thank you very much for, first and foremost, I'm a writer. But also in my professional life, I have had, as it said, my background has always been professionally in marketing, but it also has been with a lot of writing, you know, marketing, business-type writing. And so I decided to marry those two passions that I have together, which is writing and my background, and I just founded a company, Release Media, and it is an online publishing and digital marketing consulting company. And in March of this year, our company launched its first online publication, which is BeABestseller.com. And as you stated, it's an online community for writers who really want to elevate their craft to a career. There's this one meme that's out there that I really do not like, and it's called, you know, that you're a starving artist. You don't have to starve to share your creativity. You know, the world, everyone needs abundance. The artist as well as the people in this world, and everybody deserves that abundance.
Sure. Now, unfortunately, you know, a lot of our great creative minds are unfamiliar with the in the worlds of marketing. I mean, you know, there's that old adage by what's his name, Waldo Emerson something or other, or Emerson Waldo something. I can't remember. Anyway, Emerson.
Ralph Waldo Emerson. Is
it? Yes.
Is that it?
Ralph Waldo. You know, it's. I just love the sophistication of the show sometimes. Anyway, so Emerson said that, you know, that if you build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door, which sounds good on one side, but in reality is not true. You know, we know there's people out there who are great at cooking, but their restaurant failed. We have people who have written great books that nobody's ever heard of. You know, they probably sold only 10 or 15 to their dear friends and family. You know, and so it really comes out to marketing. And I don't care whether you have a company behind you like Simon and Schuster or not. It really comes down to being able to market your book. I mean, am I right?
You're absolutely correct on that, Bert. And I will tell you, there's this little dirty secret that a lot of writers really don't know, is that writers, because of our craft, we are innately we have a competitive advantage in the marketing arena because of the fact that truly good marketing is good storytelling. So when you know the elements of good storytelling, you are leaps and bounds above everybody else in the marketing arena. Now, that being said, it's how you can take those components of storytelling and then put on your marketing hat and transfer those to that that venue. So
I love it. I was just going to say, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What I was going to say was, no, you're absolutely right. All good marketing is really about just being a good storyteller. And as sophisticated as we have become, you know, what engages humanity is a good story. And that's why, you know, we call it that. That's why the guys who know how to sell really well or market really well also know how to create a very engaging story.
Absolutely. Another key element to that, too, when you're putting on your marketing hat, is that you have to be authentic. So
yes,
as long as you're being authentic in your storytelling, that is another key to that. And sometimes I feel that, you know, writers, especially right, because we're so insular,
right,
you sit behind, it's a very solitary world where it's you and a blank piece of paper or a computer screen, however you move forward with your craft, and you spill out, you know, these words that really, truly, it's like you're birthing a baby, and so it's really personal. It's a really personal endeavor. And then it's a mind shift, actually, that happens when you say, okay, I think that this is such an important story to share, but I feel uncomfortable that I'm going to be perceived like a sleazy used car salesman. You know what? Do you get
right.
that kind of analogy? Where in actuality, it's so important that with that story, I'm of the belief that the voice of these entrepreneurial-minded writers is more important than ever right now, and that if you can get out your message and you can change even one person's life, you are a bestseller in my mind's eye. I mean...
Absolutely. Well, you know what, and I think, you know, to avoid feeling like a sleazy car salesman, and no offense to our sleazy car salesman out there, but if you, you know what, if you're feeling sleazy or creepy, I think it goes back to your first suggestion or your other suggestion, which is being authentic. If you're not being authentic,
correct.
Then you get that creepy, oh, you know, this doesn't feel right to me. Then you have to go with your feeling and avoid that because you're getting off your authentic self.
Correct.
Hey, Jennifer, love to have you back. We're out of time. I'd love to have you back because I want to talk more about this. We want to help more of our entrepreneurial people out there. Guys, if you have questions for Jennifer, check her out at beabestseller.com, beabestseller.com. Jennifer Adderhold, love to have you back.
Thanks so much, Bert. Have a great
you
day,
bet.
You and your listeners. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Guys, we're off and running. Going to take a quick commercial break, and then we come back. Whitney Johnson, the Diva Disruptor, right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well... what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys. We are back. My next guest, Whitney Johnson. Whitney Johnson is a frequent contributor to the Harvard Business Review, the author of Dare, Dream, Do, Remarkable Things Happen When You Dare to Dream, and one of the 20 people to money managers to follow, and one of the 20 people for money managers to follow on Twitter, according to the Wall Street Journal, where you can find her at Johnson Whitney. Whitney Johnson, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's talk about this because, you know what, we got, you know, last time – we talked about this daring to dream thing and how, what do you call it, that in your opinion, it's still required that we have to have these dreams. And let me ask you this. When you're out there putting these dreams together, are you tying them into something measurable? Are you setting a goal as well? Because, you know, when most people hear, you know, dare, dream, do, which is the title of your book, and they hear that word dream in there, it almost goes against the business grain, don't you think? It's almost too, I don't know, too emotional, too squishy. What's your thought?
Absolutely. We in our culture have find sort of softer words like dream particularly anathema, but if you think about this idea of dreaming is something you envision that you want to happen, or if you want to look at the harder side of the soft side of dream, which is disrupt yourself, the basic premise of this, sort of the fundamental or underlying premise is you need to go forward and not backward. And in order to go forward, you have to have hope, and that involves dreams, and disrupting yourself is about propelling yourself forward. So they all come back to this fundamental idea of moving forward, of making progress. And dreams, if you don't have dreams, you just don't. You're just surviving.
Right. Now, you know what? I want you to walk me through your story, and you wrote about this in one of your articles on LinkedIn, and where you were at Salomon Smith Barney, and you left Salomon Smith Barney, and you jumped over to Merrill Lynch. Walk our listeners through this story.
Yes, I had worked my way up from secretary to investment banking and equity research analyst, and now at this point in my career, I was probably 2 or 3 years in. I was doing very well. I was receiving accolades, and I thought, you know what? I think I've kind of gotten this figured out. I'm doing a good job, and so I went to management and I said, okay, I want to move and do something else within the firm. And their response to me was, we like you just where you are. Go back and keep doing your work. And so a couple of months later, probably 6 months later, I said, all right, if I can't dream here, I'll go dream somewhere else. And so I started to orchestrate a move from Solomon Smith Barney to Merrill Lynch. And so another 4 or 5 years passed. I was doing very well as an analyst, lots of accolades, even better, sort of moving up that learning curve yet again. I went to management and I said, you know, I'd really like to do something else. I'm at the top of my game. It's time for me to dream a new dream. And they said, we really, really like you exactly where you are. And this time I said, thank you very much. And I walked out of the industry. And I found it so fascinating to me that I wanted to do good work, and instead of rewarding me with the opportunity to do more good work, they just said, just keep what you're doing, sort of like an automaton on an assembly line. And it just didn't make sense, and so I went and did something else.
Now, but let me ask you this, okay. You know, first of all, both of these companies are fairly sizable companies, and so – you know, change is difficult when you're a big company. I mean, if I was your employee and we have a small firm, you know, 10, 12 people, it's easier for you as the president of that company to say, oh, you know, that Burt guy is doing a pretty good job. And if I was to ask my manager, hey, I want to try something else, that manager may be able to come to you and say, listen, you know, this Burt guy is doing a pretty good job. Yeah, I'm aware of Burt. And he wants to try something different. Well, great. Let's see if he can succeed at this other thing. But in a big mm-hmm. company like Solomon and Merrill, you know, I could just see that as these guys not having even the empowerment, right, to help you. I mean, what's your take on that? Are some of these companies too big and just can't move?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that's part of why these larger companies at some level are being disrupted, because their culture is so established that they can't actually look at an employee as a person, as a sentient being. They instead have to look at that employee as a cog in the wheel. And for them, their approach is, okay, this cog in the wheel wants to go do something else, and they want me to continue to pay them the same amount that I've been paying them, so why don't I just let this cog in the wheel leave? I'll bring another cog in the wheel that costs me less, and it will be business as usual, which is fine at some level, again, if you're running an assembly line, but the hidden cost of that is that if you look at the assets on your balance sheet, and again, we're still counting tangible assets, property, plant, and equipment, but more and more it's the intangible assets, the intellectual property that is creating values for firms. So I absolutely agree with you that what they did made a lot of logical sense, but over the long term, the creating of value, companies have to figure out how to balance that imperative, sort of the short-term bottom line, with the long-term bottom line.
Let me ask you this. Okay, so nowadays, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're a consultant to companies. Is that correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so if you had a client like Merrill Lynch, you know, what would be your advice to some of these companies that have 300, 500, 1,000, 5,000 employees? How do you continue to innovate, or even mm-hmm. you know, encourage this innovation? You know, and again, this is just a segue. You look at Google. I think one of the reasons that Google consistently innovates, by the way, is the fact that they give their employees 20% of their, you know, whatever time to do whatever they want to mm-hmm. work on, right? And that's why they're constantly coming up. In fact, Google, I believe, made a statement that there, you know, things like Google Talk and a lot of their Google apps have come from this 20% time. So how do you advise some of these companies to disrupt themselves before they get disrupted by their competition?
Right. I think so the advice is actually twofold. One is that on the one hand, you need to allow for these intangible assets to continue to grow, which are your high performers, self-motivated people. But that also means that there needs to be a willingness to take the people who are underperformers and let them go. And, you know, there was an article in Harvard Business Review just a few days ago which talked about how you have a lot of underperformers in corporations because they figured out how to blend in. And so I think it's actually a twofold thing. It's not just, okay, you know, airy-fairy, go let the high performers do their thing, because there's
right.
a cost to that. But you can cut your costs and fund that sort of innovation by being willing to let go of the underperformers.
I love it. I love it. Guys, the book is Dare, Dream, Do by Whitney Johnson. Whitney Johnson, thank you so much for stopping by again. And, guys, if you want to check out Whitney, see if maybe she can help you with your company. WhitneyJohnson.com. It's fairly easy to remember. WhitneyJohnson.com. Again, Whitney Johnson, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thank you.
You bet. Guys, we're going to take a really short commercial break. And when we come back, we're talking with my friend Mike Michalowicz right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we're back. My next guest, Mike Michalowicz, started his first business at the age of 24, moving his young family to the only safe place he could afford, a retirement building. With no experience, no contacts, no savings, he systematically bootstrapped a multi-million dollar business. Then he did it again and again and again. Now he is doing it for other entrepreneurs as well. Mike is the CEO of Provenus Group. Hopefully I got that right. Provenus Group, a consulting firm that ignites explosive growth in companies that have plateaued. As a former business columnist for the Wall Street Journal and MSNBC business makeover expert, he's a keynote speaker on entrepreneurship and the author of the cult classic, The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. His newest book, The Pumpkin Plan, has already been called the next e-myth. Decide for yourself. Mike Michalowicz, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Hey, so let's talk about this. What the heck is the pumpkin plan? I'm thinking, you know, is this a pie baking strategy? What is it?
Well, it's a business baking strategy, but in a good sense of baking, not like baking the books. And basically, I studied pumpkin farmers, but not any pumpkin farmer, the extraordinary ones, the ones that grow colossal pumpkins, and found that they change the growing process from the ordinary guys just by a few things, but the pumpkin responds with explosive growth. Well, I ran the parallel to business. Most entrepreneurs run very ordinary businesses, struggle in the day-to-day, but the ones who have colossal success change the exact same few things, and the business responds with explosive organic growth.
I love it. I love it. All right, so let's talk about this, because I've heard you say that most entrepreneurs just need a 5% change. What does that mean? Because I'm thinking all these guys that are listening today to the show and are going to hear this later on are going to say, man, if I could change my business by doing just 5%, that would be crazy. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so if you think about your business, most people listening right now, you're attracting prospects, you're converting those prospects to customers, you're bringing in revenue. I mean, you got the basics down. The 5%
right.
that needs to change is inevitably focus. Inevitably, the entrepreneurs that struggle, the business owners that struggle, are trying to be everything to everyone. The classic way to identify someone like this is if they start off their definition of a prospect with the words anyone who. So they say, you know, I can service anyone who is in this area or anyone who. No, that's already way too broad. businesses that focus very specifically on one target customer and do everything to master that relationship, to service them better than any of the competitors ever could, that is the 5% that needs to be focused on.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So in other words, if I'm hearing you correctly, a lot of our entrepreneurs are making the mistake of trying to be too big of a net, going too broad, and they should really zero in on niching down their customers, really trying to laser focus who their customer is.
That's exactly it. And here's a classic example. I live in the New York area. Fall's going to be coming real soon. The guys who rake leaves are going to be coming around. And inevitably, what a guy thinks, if he does raking leaves for a business, he'll say, well, if I'm at the house already, maybe I can also use a power wash and wash the side of the house for them. I'll offer that. And then since I'm climbing up a ladder, I might as well go on the roof, clean out the gutters, and I can fix roofs. And I'm up there, there's a chimney there, I might as well become a chimney cleaner too. And that's an extreme explanation or example, but so many businesses think that they can go deeper and deeper with a customer. I have a captive audience. We've heard that a million times. Why do I offer all these things? But the difference between raking leaves and cleaning chimneys is huge. The tools you need, the insurance, all these things. Even the difference between raking leaves and cleaning the side of a house. Different tools, different efficiencies. I don't care what business you're in. The second you start going deep, you start losing the efficiencies. You have to get different tools, different people with different capabilities. You become ultra inefficient, and we lose our ability to gain profitability, and inevitably we stay stuck in that, I can't grow a business, I have to do it all myself because there's so many things to do. I can't find people that can replace me because I'm the best at it. That's because we're too wide. We're not mastering the one thing and then training others to do it repeatedly.
All right, so let's talk about this. Let's take the leaf raker example because I think that's a great example. I think a lot of people are probably saying the same thing I'm going to ask you, and that is, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, yeah, I understand that you just mentioned, hey, you're going too wide, but if I am raking this guy's yard, I'm raking your yard, shouldn't I also try to get you for mowing your lawn and maybe, you know, power washing your driveway and stuff like that? What's wrong with that? Or should I just come – or when? Maybe that's the right question. When should I start looking at going deeper? What's your thought?
Well, I'll answer both of those. Why is it the wrong strategy? Is because when we look at doing all those things, that is a sales mentality exclusively. We say, hey, we have a captive customer here. I can sell more to them. And from the sales perspective, it's absolutely right. Once you have a captive customer, you've accomplished no like and trust. Now you can go deeper. But it ignores the most important part, which is the execution. Just because you can sell more doesn't mean you're the world's best at it. And when you can't execute perfectly on it, you're inefficient. And when you focus on something that's not your core competency, you're trying to do something else, your core competency becomes less efficient. You take your limited resources of execution, your ability to do things, and are spreading it out thinner and thinner, and you never become masterful at it. The right time to go deep is once you've mastered a niche. Focus on that one category that you're serving and serve them better than anyone else and become masterful at it. One huge example is UGG boots. UGG didn't come out for like all teenage girls and stuff. That came out in the 70s only for surfers in the Australian market. They were making these boots for guys that are coming in off the surf in the winter and their feet were freezing, and these were specialized boots. They dominated that market until that market said, UGG is the de facto choice. I'm not going to get any other shoe wear. I'm only buying UGG. Then they went broad. So until your niche starts saying, you are the de facto choice, I'm not going anywhere else, you haven't mastered your niche.
You know what, and I like your strategy there. The other example that came to mind when you're saying all this is Microsoft. You know, whether you like, you know, what do you call it, Internet Explorer, the reality is that they dominated the browser industry for many years. At one point, they had 95% of that market. So then that's when they started launching things like Hotmail and Xbox and all these other side businesses, if you will. They dominated one. Then they didn't say, oh, by the way, we're Microsoft Explorer. We can also do your email. They launched that as a completely separate entity and subsidiary, and they did the same thing with Xbox. They weren't trying to tie all these together, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I see a lot of people do, and you give me your opinion, is is it not only do they try to go wide way too soon, but they try to lump it all into one. So, hey, I rake your leaves, I paint your house, I, you know, clean your carpet, I, you know, do this, and eventually, you know, your brand doesn't stand for anything.
No, you're totally right, and it's a shame. There's these common buzzwords, you know, one-stop shop,
right.
Captive audience. That sounds so appealing, but I'm telling you, they're not. I can't think of one company that didn't first go deep to become successful. Microsoft's a great example. They, in fact, if you rewind totally in their history, started off with DOS. That was the only thing they did. Bill Gates was programming DOS for IBM computers, not anything else, IBM computers. And then when he mastered that, then they expanded into Windows into these other products, Internet Explorer, you're saying. And only when they were totally masterful did they start going more and more broad. Procter & Gamble, like, you know, they make a million products. People say, you know, they make from Crest toothpaste to dish soap, everything. Well, they started off with one thing, Ivory soap. That was their one product. They took it to about 10 million and then broadened out. So I can't think of one company that didn't go first deep before they went broad. And anyone that's trying to go broad, I've never seen not struggle and become stagnant.
Right.
You don't have enough resources to go deep. Not yet. Wait until you're, you know,
right.
10 million or 100 million in revenue. Then you can talk about going broad.
Right. You know, and then the other thing is this, you know, something that you kind of alluded to is that is, you know, here you are, your resources are stretched thin. You're no longer being competent in your original or your core service, which is raking the leaves. And so now if you happen to screw up this guy's chimney or this guy's the guy's chimney, now you're liable to lose that customer for everything versus just one thing.
That's so funny. I talk about the exact same thing in the pumpkin plant in my book. I talk about the story of the guy who starts going broader and broader, and now he's panicking. He's answering phone calls and trying to cover all the mistakes his little team is making. Because the chimney guy, you know, if I do one chimney, I'll run into some problems. I do 1,000 chimneys, I'll run into the most extreme problems, and I'll be prepared for those odd circumstances. And that's where mastery happens, where it's thousands of repeated times. Actually, Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his book Outliers, we need to spend 10,000 hours doing something before we master it. Well, same with the business. We have to execute thousands of projects before we're truly masterful at it. And if we start broadening out before we've mastered one thing, those, you know, the phone rings at 2 a.m. in the morning and the next panic comes in, you got to fly out and solve the emergency of something that you messed up.
Right. You know, and I love that quote by Gladwell because it reminds me of when you look at the masters in the industry, karate. You know, to be a master of karate, to earn that black belt, it's, I believe, only 6 or 7 moves. You know, when you look at, you know, Michael Jordan, who is the master of basketball, you know, he didn't have 1,000 things that he did. He only had a few things that he did 1,000 times. He had mastered them, right? You couldn't – you knew what he was going to do. You saw him coming. You couldn't stop him because he was brilliant at those basic 3 or 4 moves, and you never could stop him. He was the master.
Yeah, and could you imagine taking Michael Jordan, the world's greatest basketball player, and trying to make him play baseball, which they did, and he failed, right? I mean, the world's best basketball player does not make you the world's best athlete across the board. So when he tried out for baseball, he went to the minors. He wasn't able to manage the major leagues. Because you're right, mastery is in doing a few things so well that no one else can achieve it. And the second he tried to do baseball, too, he started taking his focus off basketball. His baseball didn't work at all. And thank God for him, he went right back to going full-time basketball. And that's what we all need to be. Commit to that one thing where your natural strengths and talents are in your business and grow around that and do everything to do it over and over and over again and stay focused on it.
You know what? And what I'd like to do is I'd like to have you back because of my ADD, we completely – got off the topic, and we didn't really go, you know, speaking of going deep, we didn't get a chance to go deep into the pumpkin plan. So I'd love to bring it back and talk more about the pumpkin plan, because I love this analogy of the pumpkin plan. You know, and in there you have the steps of the pumpkin plan, you have the seed selection, you have all the stuff to grow a colossal business. And so I'd love to have you back and talk more about the pumpkin plan.
I would love to be back. You got a deal.
All righty, Mike Michalowicz, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
You bet. Guys, that wraps it up. Great stuff there. Check out the Pumpkin Plan. Better yet, check out Mike, and you can go to Mike, ICZ.com. Anyway, just Google the Pumpkin Plan. You'll get over to Mike, and he'll be able to take care of you. Guys, as always, we appreciate you being here. We truly appreciate you spreading the word. We'll talk to you later.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.